We practice, you know? I mean, we practice asking questions as opposed to jumping in to correct that person immediately. We practice being really genuinely curious. I started learning so much once I genuinely committed to that practice.
I'm J.R. Jameson. Today on The Facing Project, I sit down with author, actor, and activist Sarah Sharp to talk about radical love and empathy and the organization she founded called The Letters Project, a bridge-building organization that provides space for an ongoing series of love letters from her, a liberal left-leaning woman, to a conservative right-leaning friend. Stay with us. This season, I'm doing something a little different to mix up our format. I'll still share stories from past Facing Projects to shine a light on specific topics and issues. But also, I'll sit down for long-form interviews with best-selling authors, filmmakers, and other artists who are using their platforms to make the world a more understanding and empathetic place. Asking each of them this question: how do we create a more empathetic world in a time when listening has decreased and each person's message is competing with millions of others? Today's guest is Sarah Sharp, an author, actor, and activist based in Chattanooga, who categorizes herself as a liberal, left-leaning woman. But in the wake of the 2016 election and the years that have passed by since, Sarah has done something courageous. She decided to move beyond conversations that divide most folks and write love letters to her conservative-leaning friends. These letters grew into civil discourse practices that moved into deeper issues that do often divide folks, and it grew into the Letters Project, her organization that provides the space for the letters to continue, not only from her, but from others who want to write letters to past friends and loved ones across the divide. It's truly a space that leads with radical love and empathy. Sarah Sharp, author, actor, activist, coach, and founder of The Letters Project, thank you so much for joining me on The Facing Project.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Letters Project is an act of courage, and it's really a beautiful testament to empathy. Why did you decide to start it?
So, if I'm honest, I would have to say that I started The Letters Project because I could feel my empathy waning in some ways. Even though I had done a lot of this bridge building work in the past, I think that when President Trump was elected, there suddenly seemed to be this idea that the time for polite conversation had come and gone. You know, mm-hmm. if you were a left-leaning person, as I am, mm-hmm. there was this idea that the house was on fire and we had to be about, you know, saving people and protecting people from harm. And I don't think we were wrong about that, but I think that we forgot for a moment that we can actually, you know, hold two things at one time, mm-hmm. and that we could be on the front lines of change making while also remember that reaching across the political divide, if we are to move forward in a way that is effective and long lasting, is a necessity. You know, it's not a luxury. Mm-hmm. But it was hard because I think in the activist circles that I ran in, reaching across the political divide was for a time seen as a betrayal of sorts, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So the Letters Project was my way back in to that mm-hmm. bridge building work.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that some people still see it as a betrayal to connect across divides?
No, I think that has changed. I haven't gotten that feedback at all, which surprises me a little bit because mm-hmm. in the beginning I really thought that I was creating this project that was important to me and I felt was important in general, but that was just kind of make everybody angry, you know, people on both sides of the divide. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't turned out to be the case. I've gotten a little bit of negative feedback, but by and large, the feedback has been really good. I think people find it hopeful. Mm-hmm. I think most people very much want to bridge the divide. They just don't know how.
I find that too in my own work that I do, that people aren't sure how to do it, but we have reached a time where people want something different and they want to find ways to heal past relationships, maybe heal their own hearts that have been battered and tattered over the last several years. And I think we're at a moment in time where this can happen, right? Where it's a time where we can, and it takes brave people like you to say, let's do this. And I don't know, it may be messy, but we're going to figure this out, right? And we're going to work together on doing this.
Yeah.
You open your website for the Letters Project with a really powerful and beautiful statement that I'd love for you to read if you're willing to do that.
Sure. Dear friends, the Letters Project presents an ongoing series of letters from me, Sarah, a liberal left-leaning woman, to a conservative right-leaning one. I consider them to be love letters. Who is this conservative friend to whom I write? Though I do have one woman in mind, this friend ultimately is a composite of several conservative women I know or have known. Importantly, for the purposes of this exercise, this friend is my ideological opposite in every way. When I insist that Black Lives Matter, for instance, this friend would be quick to point out that blue ones do. If I am pro-choice, friend is pro-life. If I do not believe the election was stolen, friend suspects it might have been. And so on. My purpose in writing these letters is not to open the lines of communication, as it were. That would be impossible, given that these letters are a one-way street. Rather, my goal is to humanize women on both sides of the divide in as much as I can, to look beyond the signs and slogans each of them might hold at a protest, for instance, and to refuse to settle for stereotypes dished up by politicians or pundits and then reinforced by social media. I hope these letters remind us that we are none of us one-dimensional villains. Finally, these letters are an antidote to the prevailing idea that the time for polite conversation has come and gone. True, not everyone can afford to facilitate dialogue across the ideological divide any more than firefighters can routinely engage in friendly roundtable discussion next to a house on fire. We need activists on the front lines, putting out fires and fighting for policy change that should have been enacted yesterday. But even frontline activists need reminders that vitriolic hatred tends to bring all forward momentum to a screeching halt, and that we do not have time for that which bogs us down. And not for nothing, it remains true that there is no more powerful force for change than love. We would do well to remember that, even now. Especially now. Love, Sarah.
How hard was it for you to write that opening letter and commit to this journey?
Yeah, it was not at all hard to write the letter, but it has been hard to commit to the journey, as you say. Having let myself devolve into a place of rage and fear as I did, it took a fair amount of discipline, you know, to shift into a new and different place, into a place of loving kindness and tolerance. And, you know, one does not become a beacon of tolerance overnight. I spent the last year getting into good physical shape, which required regular training. And this hasn't been any different. I've had to develop a new musculature. I'm not sure that I'm a beacon of tolerance now, but I want to be. I want to be. And so I am committed to the journey, even though it's hard.
You write about love, and I think about radical love often. I'm the basis of the work that I do and that you do too is steeped in empathy. And I talk about radical empathy all of the time, right? And this idea that we have to empathize with even those we don't agree with. And that's radical empathy, right? But I had a friend tell me recently, it's also radical love. And so we have to think about how do we love those we disagree with? And is love really a path forward? And kind of love and empathy together. Do you find this too in your work?
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, I think that's so important. And I think this is not a feel good exercise, you know, talking about radical love and trying to engage in radical love. It is, It is the only way. It is the only way forward. So I had an experience a couple of months ago when I was driving down to my local pharmacy and I was in my neighborhood and probably not paying, you know, close enough attention. And I made some kind of boneheaded move. I don't even remember what it was, but whatever, I, you know, got too far in somebody's lane or something. I just remember that it was clearly my fault. And there, this fellow came up from behind me and JR, he just came uncorked. He was screaming. He was raging. I have experienced road rage. I know what it is now. He was red in the face and I rolled down my window. And when he stopped, I said, "I am so sorry. What I did was really unfair to you. And I am so sorry to have, you know, put you out and scared you in that way." And I, the look on his face was so interesting. I wish someone had been doing a brain scan of his brain at that point, because it would have been really interesting. And he just didn't know what to do. And he said, well, that's fine. But it was just bizarre. But I feel like that is one moment when I was able to, you know, inject some love into what could have been a really ugly situation. I am not always able to do that. I'm, you know, at a fairly, you know, happy place in my life. My life is relatively stress-free compared to, you know, times in the past. And so I was able to bring that. And who knows what he was going through that day? I mean, he could have just lost his job. He could have been fighting with his partner. Who knows? But I feel like there was some magic in that, you know, in that radical act of love. And on the first page of my letter project, there is a quote from St. John of the Cross. I don't know if you've heard it, where there is no love, put love and you will find love. And if that's not a magic formula, I don't know what is. That is radical love at its core. And I think that, you know, as often as we can employ that, we should.
That reminds me of the quote, and I don't know the quote word for word, but about, you know, always be kind because you don't know what someone else is going through, like you just said. And I continue to realize, especially during this time we're living in, where we are so siloed in some ways, algorithms on social media, right, whichever way they may trigger or they may move us toward, or in the case of X, formerly Twitter, that's been dropped. And so, right, we're starting to see, or at least I'm starting to see, maybe opinions that I don't totally agree with that kind of triggers my anxiety a little bit and all of that. So through all of that, I continue to think we have a lot of people walking around in the world who are hurt. They're hurt because of something somebody has said to them or done or something they've seen on social media. News is being thrown at us constantly. Misinformation is being thrown at us constantly too. And it just feels like the world is on edge. And I agree with you, those moments even when you could have screamed back at the guy, right? Like, why are you being a jerk? And that could have escalated into an even bigger argument. But instead, you chose radical love to say, listen, I'm sorry, here's the deal. And I know I created this stress. And he didn't know what to do because it's not often that people practice radical love, right? And so I agree with you on that. Like if we can practice more radical love and empathy, maybe that's the answer to healing the world. And I want to talk about a little more about this. There's actually another letter on your site, and I promise I won't go through every letter, but there are some letters that are pieces of your letters that have stuck out to me that I kind of want to go through. And there's one that's letter two, actually, you write, and I'll just read a piece of that now. When we meet again, and I hope we do, we'll have to do things differently than we did before. I'd like to someday reopen the lines of communication, and I'm serious about that. But with new ground rules, this time, new priorities. In the past, we prioritized being heard. We prioritized being right. We prioritized winning the argument, making the irrefutable point, having the last word. From here on out, I'm going to prioritize listening and asking questions. My goal will be to understand where you're coming from. Like, for real, I want to be more interested in understanding than in being understood. I want to ask questions as opposed to beating you about the head and shoulders with my rightness and your wrongness. I want to be curious as opposed to judgmental. As Ted Lasso would say, and you had a parenthetical here, have you seen that show? We can all agree that's a great show. And see, we're already doing better, right? And I'll argue Ted Lasso may save the world, right? But you continue, I want to give you my take on things, but never at the expense of your take on things. I found that a really, like we were just talking about, a radical love and empathy moment. And in some ways saying, I may have values and I believe I'm right in some areas, but I know you feel that way too. And if we're going to just continue to beat each other about with our ideals and what we think is right, we're never going to get anywhere. But the only way of doing that is saying, okay, I'm going to step back for a moment and I'm going to really listen to you. And listening and radical love and empathy is part of that. But how else do we get there?
More and more, I'm just convinced that we get there by creating a feeling of safety within ourselves and others. So for years, I thought that when it came to bridge building, kindness was the keyword. And I think kindness is absolutely a prerequisite. But I've decided that actually the keyword is safety. So when we're faced with a difficult conversation, we often feel very threatened. And you know, there are clues in our language. We talk about someone threatening our worldview, for instance. And so what we have to understand is that our bodies have a very real biological reaction to this perceived threat, right? We respond physically as if there were a hungry tiger in the room. And then our breathing becomes shallow. The communication center of our brain goes offline. The reptilian part of our brain takes over and nothing good happens, you know, when we get to that point. But we all know that horrible feeling, you know, that horrible physical feeling that you get when you're having a really difficult conversation with somebody. And that happens, as I am coming to understand it, because we attach our feeling of safety to another person. And so we are convinced on some level that we will not be safe again until we can convince that person to come over to our way of thinking, right? Which likely is not going to happen. And so, you know, what do we do about that? And I think, first of all, it's helpful just to understand and acknowledge that that's happening, you know, so that we can kind of watch it. And when we can feel ourselves feeling uncomfortable, then we can stop and take a deep breath and say, okay, I understand that I'm having a physical, biological reaction to this conversation. And we can then remind ourselves in our brains that we are, in fact, safe, there's no physical threat in the room with us at that moment. And I think that until we learn to do those things, that then it everything else is really hard. But if we can remember, you know, to remind ourselves that we're safe, and to then think about creating a safe space for whoever it is that we're talking with. Because we're learning that our nervous systems actually talk to and respond to one another, which is fascinating. And then, you know, we practice, you know, I mean, we practice asking questions as opposed to jumping in to correct that person immediately. We practice being really genuinely curious. I started learning so much once I genuinely committed to that practice, recommitted to that practice. And started asking people, you know, how they came to feel this way about that. But so yes, kindness is important, but I think a feeling of safety is foundational.
I agree with you. It reminds me of a journey I took with my own father, who is on the complete opposite side politically, culturally than I am. And you know this because you've read my book, but
I'm going to take a minute to plug your book because you probably won't, but it's so wonderful. And it is, I mean, you guys really set an example for the rest of us of how to just be loving, even when, you know, you're on very opposite sides of the divide.
Yeah, thank you for that, because I probably wouldn't have plugged my own book other than sharing this story. So amazing. So I do thank you for that, and thank you for reading it and saying those kind words. But it really was a journey of trying to find that connection back to my own father during a time where our country felt like it was on fire. And going back to this concept of radical love and empathy, I felt like the most radical thing I could do in that moment is to actually take a trip with my dad across the country to go back to his hometown to see where he came from and maybe get a better understanding of him and learn how to bite my lips sometimes or bite my tongue and when I needed to speak up and when it felt right. And when you talked about safety, it reminded me of, after going through that journey with him and investing the time and reconnecting, coming back to Indiana where we live and continuing that conversation all the way through the 2016 election and beyond, it made me realize how much my dad and I are alike. I started to recognize how similar we were and stopped really focusing on our differences, even though those are important, right? And we can't just ignore those. We do have to cross those bridges and have those conversations across our differences, but also just like realizing how similar we are and focusing on our similarities and having that as a loving point can jump to other places. And thinking about safety, there's a part I write about in the book where I realized as we got closer to the election and people were more and more choosing sides and trying to figure out ways to demonize those who were not on the same side as them, I started to realize that was happening to my dad, not him feeling that way, but people demonizing my father when I would have conversations with them about the journey that we took. And I write about this in my book where I said, who's going to protect my dad from me, from people like me, my people, right? And that was just a really eye-opening moment to me that not everybody could embrace this idea of radical love, but those we are practicing radical love with, how do we protect them when we kind of make it public and talk to others about our radical love and empathy? And I still don't know if I have that completely figured out.
Yeah. I don't know either, but I think that it's a brave and necessary thing that you and your dad did. It's a risk that you took. But those are risks that we have to take now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going back to the safety idea and social media and algorithms and silos and all of that, I do find myself, especially when I'm on X, that I'm seeing messages that I don't necessarily agree with. And because it's not a space where I can have a conversation like I do with my dad, right? Somebody in the flesh, somebody who knows my history, I know his history, and we're finding this connection similar to you're writing these letters, right? To friends. But I find in spaces where I don't know the person, and if they're saying something that I don't totally agree with, I kind of go internal and I hold that frustration, that confusion, and that anger, and that does not create healthy thinking. What do you say about that when it comes to your work around that too?
I think this is where practice comes in, right? Mm-hmm. So I think in so many ways that feeling is inevitable. Mm-hmm. We're all going to react that way to some degree. At least I am at this point, and I hear you saying that you are at this point too. But if we commit to this work, then in those moments of real tension, we have scripts to rely on, you know, that we have practiced. And we can talk to our brains and we can talk to our bodies and we can remind ourselves that we're safe, which goes a long way. And we can understand that there is a person on the other side of that argument or that comment or that screen, or table, you know, if you happen to be in the same space, that is also feeling really threatened and really scared. And I think, you know, it is that fear that drives that rage. And so if we can somehow see beyond the rage and remember that the impetus is fear, then that takes the edge off of our own fear and anger, maybe just enough that we can, you know, employ that radical love that we're so committed to.
I love with your project, your writing to friends. And in some way you say it's a composite of many friends. And I find too, with practicing radical love and empathy, I have to do it with people I actually know and people I've loved before. And I find that an easier jumping off point. I've actually had people argue with me and say, oh, I could never have a conversation with my dad like that. I'd much rather argue with a stranger and figure it out through there. But I don't know, my own body, and maybe it's me or maybe it's right, the both of us, but my own body tells me really it's those who we've loved before that we need to figure out, right, these conversations with them. Because if we can figure out paths back to people we once loved and have these conversations, does that open the opportunity to go deeper with those who we don't know, who we don't disagree with? And I'm still working through all of that myself, but I think that's the answer.
Yeah, I think it depends on your situation. So I think that what I know about your story is that your dad is a really loving man. He just kind of beams love at the world. I say that having just read, you know, your account of him, having never met him. But so, you know, if we think in terms of safety, then he has, in the end, created a safe space for you. And maybe, you know, other strangers in the world who might not know and love and accept you right out of the gate in that same way, feels less safe to you. And for other folks, it might be really different. You know, folks who don't have parents who are as loving, that might feel a lot less safe, but much more threatening than talking to someone that they have never placed their feeling of safety in. So I think that's probably different. For everybody, but I'm so glad for you that you have that feeling with your family and with your dad especially. And it's a testament to both of you because you're so different. You think so differently.
And I think you're right. It depends on who your family is and if you're able to have those kind of conversations, because it is true that not everybody can, and it's not safe for them to do that. So thank you for acknowledging that when I get lost sometimes in my own, like, this is the answer, is connecting with your family. And the reality is that's just not always true for everyone. I want to talk about another letter on your site. It's letter 5. And I loved this one because there was a bit of humor in there. And at first, when I started reading the letter, I was thinking, oh, where is this going? I don't think this is going to end up very well. And I want to read just a little piece of the letter to Yasmin. You say, for the purposes of this letter project, and at the risk of way overreaching here, I'll just say that it's hard to be angry at someone, no matter the wacky circumstances and late hour, who hugs you good-naturedly and tells you again and again that you're beautiful people, right? At least for me. Tell us more about this experience with Yasmin that led to this letter.
So, JR, you want to know how it is that my husband came to bring another woman to our hotel room in the middle of the night, right?
Yes, I have to say, what I did not share is you opened the letter in that way. And I was like, oh, boy, this one is going to get really deeply personal here. And I don't know. But it was a hook. It kept me reading, I will say for sure.
That's funny. Okay. Well, so what happened was that my husband and I were at this conference. My husband is an engineer, so we were at some nerdy conference having to do with GPS technology. And I went to bed one night early, back to the hotel room, and my husband stayed out with a friend. And I was good and asleep, and he showed up at some point, and I could hear him talking with someone and saying something like, why don't you just go potty? And so someone goes into my bathroom and I'm sort of trying to wake up wondering what's going on. And my husband goes into the hall and I can hear him talking with somebody. And then at the same time, the bathroom door opens. My husband walks back into the hotel room and I see this woman standing there. And my husband is saying, I can explain. So at this point, I'm really trying to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman, who turns out to be Yasmin, takes one look at me, throws open her arms and charges over and gives me a big hug in bed. And, you know, I'm not all the way dressed. And so this is all a little bit weird. And I'm still trying to wake up and figure out what's going on. And my husband is being no help at all because he's standing in the corner giggling. And what I discover is that my husband was coming in that night. And in front of our hotel room at the convention center, there was this woman just fast asleep in front of our door. And two young men there, really lovely young men, who were trying to figure out what to do with her. And they'd called the manager, and the manager was on the way up. So I get dressed and go out into the hallway. And there's Yasmin and my husband and these two men. The manager comes up, and somehow she finally remembers her room number. So this being Colorado, she has two bags of snacks for what I can only presume, you know, were the munchies. So the night manager takes her back. We all go with her like this, you know, fun little Yasmin parade. We follow her to her room. We get her delivered. And, you know, she's just telling us the whole time what wonderful, beautiful people we are. And we're you know, offering her all kinds of helpful and loving advice. And obviously, I wrote the letter, you know, partly just because it's a fun and funny story. And in the Letters Project, we're writing about some heavy and hard things. So we have to have some levity in there now mm-hmm. and again. But also, it's an example of a time when we all just chose love. You know, we could have responded in lots of different ways. We could have been really irritated by the fact that we got or that I got woken up in the middle of the night and that there was this woman passed out in front of our door. But none of us responded that way, including Yasmin. There was just lots of, you know, kindness and affection. And in the end, it turned out to be kind of a charming story.
Yeah. And it could have gone totally differently, right? And Yasmin in the letter, Yasmin comes out of the bathroom, right? And just has this really positive attitude and like, let me explain. There's nothing, you know, hokey going on here, right? And so in some ways, Yasmin also helped diffuse that situation by showing her showing her own, making fun of the situation, but also, you know, just her presence came off through your writing and through that letter as a beam of light who was like, no, yes. Wait, that turned into this really beautiful and tender moment. And I think it's going back to everything we just discussed around radical love and empathy. And there's something about those two things together that are just really magical, even when it's right 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in a hotel room in Colorado. So, yeah.
So there's one other story that I want to tell that I think kind of speaks to radical love and empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is an instance in which I chose well, I think in retrospect. I don't always, this story, like the other one, could fall under the category of I don't always get it right, but sometimes I do. But years ago, this is when cell phones were just making the scene. My mother mm-hmm. had bought us a cell phone, and I had a 3-year-old and a newborn at the time. And we were so excited. We'd never seen or used, you know, cell phones before. We plugged it in at night so it could be charged by the next morning. We went to bed. I woke up in the wee hours so excited to try my new cell phone. So I toddle out in the darkness into the living room, and I'm feeling around for my cell phone, and it's gone.
Mm.
And I thought, why did my husband have gotten up in the middle of the night and moved the cell phone? And I thought, oh, he wouldn't have. So I started looking around, and my TV was gone. My stereo was gone. Oh. All the drawers were open, and I froze because I thought maybe these people, whoever they are still in the house. And turned out they weren't. I went back to bed where I just, you know, laid there paralyzed until my husband woke up. And we got up. And I got a cell phone bill a few weeks later. I want to say that the experience really changed my life. The folks who came in through the back door and went through every room in the house save for our bedroom. And luckily, my children were both sleeping with us in our room that night. But I couldn't sleep You know, from then on, I started getting a stomachache every time it got dark. It was not a you know, pleasant or easy experience. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying desperately to figure out who it was, because I had this idea that if I could figure it out, I would feel better and I could relax. And in fact, I did, because I got this cell phone, and it turned out, to make a long story short, that the kid who had lived in the house before we did, who was a football star in our small town, mm-hmm. he was the one who broke in with some of his friends. He knew the house, he knew how to get in the back door. And when I got the cell phone bill, I just started calling the numbers, mm-hmm. And trying to figure out who these people were, trying to, you know, figure out if my theory about this kid was right. So in the end it was, and weirdly, I was really angry. And because this person had changed my life, and mm-hmm. I would see him every now and again in town, and I'm sure he could feel my anger, and boy, did he send it back. It was like this weird sort of standoff. And at the time I was working for an anti-death penalty organization, and we worked with these men on death row who were pod leaders and representatives, and we had meetings with them. And so I was talking to one of these pod leaders one day, telling him this story. And he said, boy, that really sounds like me when I was a young man. And I really wish that someone had talked to me and offered me a way out. And I said, would you have listened? And he said, I don't know, but I wish someone had tried. And I said, well, if I ever see this person, I will try. Mm-hmm. And so I told my husband this story that night, and he said, don't you dare. That wouldn't be safe. Don't do that. The very next morning, JR, mm-hmm. true story, I'm driving down my road. This kid's grandmother lived down the road. I remember driving down and seeing him sitting alone. He was never alone. But on this morning, the morning after I had said that to my friend and my husband, he was sitting alone. And so I pulled my car over before I even knew what I was doing. And I got out of the car and I motioned him over and I said, blank, I want you to know that the night that you broke into my house changed my life. And he immediately started saying, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't do that. And I just kind of ignored him and went on and told him about the work that I was doing. And I told him about what my friend had said. And I said, you know, I just want you to know that if you ever get tired of this life, if you want to do something different, I will help you.
Oh.
And the look on his face was like the look on the face of the guy that I responded to with some semblance of loving kindness when we had our road rage incident.
Mm-hmm.
He just stopped talking completely and he just said, thank you. And I knew in that moment, I knew right down to my DNA that he would never hurt me again. I knew I could feel that if his friends wanted to come back to my house, that he would not let them. There was some magic in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the more often we choose to respond with that radical love, as you put it,
mm-hmm.
The more we change things in a deep and real and lasting way.
Mm-hmm. You could have gone in a totally different direction, just like with the episode with the guy in the vehicle, right? You could have sat him down and said, you have ruined my life and I will never forgive you for this. And that conversation could have been totally different, but just think about maybe how that changed him in that moment by just telling him what you said. And you saw immediately his response was, thank you. It reminds me, you know, you were talking about just this anger that he was giving back to you when he had done something right to you. But when there was kind of this space between you and this distance, but when you'd see each other from afar, there was kind of this anger that was filling that space. Anger really is not anger itself. Anger often underneath, right, has hurt in it. It has fear.
Or fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fear under it. And some people don't know how to regulate their emotions. And so it comes out as anger. People mm-hmm. often say, right, like the child comes out when people are afraid. when they're confused. Right. And all of this is bottling up. It may come out in that way. And what a powerful statement in that moment for you to say to someone who had broken into your home, taken your possessions, created chaos in your life, for you to essentially extend an olive branch to him and to have that conversation and for him to respond and say thank you just shows, again, that radical love in those situations. You got to choose wisely, right? It's not every situation radical love could be applied, I don't think. Right. I don't know. I have to think about that a little more. There are some situations that might be, going back to safety, that might be a little dangerous to practice radical love. But I think we know, we feel it in ourselves. Like, did you feel that as you were approaching him, that I'm safe and I'm going to practice radical love? Yeah,
I think I did. And I had gone for so many months feeling unsafe in a way that I had never experienced before. It was really genuinely awful. And in that one moment, that all that really flipped on its head. And I no longer felt afraid of him.
Have you talked to him since or after that moment? Did you see? Yeah.
No, I never talked to him again. He did go on to get into some trouble. Yeah, and I don't have any idea where he is now, but I like to think that he remembers that moment.
Yeah.
I hope he does anyway. I think it's important too to remember that we can practice that sort of response, that sort of loving kindness in little ways too. And I have taken to practicing every now and again on Instagram, which is kind of the only social media that I can handle these days, that and a little Facebook. But I will intentionally enter into some discussions that have gotten kind of nasty. You know, there are so many of them. It's not hard to find one. And just having a discussion and practicing, you know, injecting some loving kindness without, and I think this is really important, without watering down my own ideas and beliefs at all. I think bridge building is not about that. And we all have to understand that we can hold fervently to our beliefs. Well, remembering that, you know, it's important to open up these lines of communication. And so just going in and practicing a little bit, maybe modeling some of that behavior, and almost always it works like magic. You can diffuse a situation just even a tiny bit makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. You know, at the very least you become a cog in the wheel when it comes to amping up the rhetoric and the anger. Mm-hmm. So I think it's good to practice those skills when we can. And obviously there are times when I can't. There are times when I just don't have it in me. And that's fine. I think that's true for all of us. But in those moments that we can, we should.
Bridge building is such hard work. It sounds, in some ways, when I describe bridge building work to people who aren't familiar with the movement, they think it's kind of Pollyannish in some ways, right? Like, oh, everybody is kind of holding hands and dancing around, and that's just not reality, right? But the truth is, it's really hard work, and it takes effort from both sides or multiple sides to say, we're not going to agree on everything, but we all agree that what's happening now is not working. So let's figure out a better path forward together for our own sanity, for our country's sanity, and all of that. I also think about our own personal stories, which can be a form of bridge building, even when we just share our own authentic selves in a way where we're open to questions, right? We say to somebody who maybe, you know, they don't agree with our stance, but we share our own personal narrative around that and speak from our own lived experience and truth, how that, in a way where it's not pointing fingers, allows space for discussion. I found this before when I've traveled around. I do a lot of campus speaking, and when I've done that in the past, I'll often share my coming out story on stage and talk about these moments, like with my father and other people in my life. And I'm surprised the people who come to talk to me afterward are not often people who totally get it and agree with me. They're people who maybe they felt a little uncomfortable in that moment, or maybe my own personal story challenged something in their own belief system. But telling it in a way where it's, this is my lived experience, and leading with kindness and love in that conversation, I've had religious leaders say to me before, and you know, this can be hard to hear, especially when it's a part of my identity. I don't agree with you, but you made me think about X, Y, and Z. And part of bridging is allowing that space for the conversation where I could easily jump back in and say, well, you could disagree all you want, but this is my lived experience in my life, right? I could fight back. But instead, it's having the audacity to listen, which is really important, right?
I like that. The audacity to listen.
Audacity to listen. I feel like listening is a radical concept too, especially in the day and age we're living
in.
It can feel radical to say, I'm just going to listen, which is what you're doing so much in your project. I know we've talked a bit about these friends that you speak of in your letter, and you have several of them, right? I believe in your mind as you're writing these letters and different experiences that you've had with them. Do you think at some point that going through this process that there could be a rekindling of relationships?
Yeah, there could be. The women that I think of most often as I write, there are actually two that I have in mind almost all the time. We lost touch not so much because of our political beliefs, but because they moved and I moved, and we stayed in touch on Facebook until we didn't, until the things that we were posting just got too painful, I think. Mm-hmm. That's my perception. So I would be very happy to see either one of these women. Mm-hmm. Very happy. And I think a few years ago, I would not have felt that way. Mm-hmm. I think that it would have felt hard. And now I feel like that would be quite lovely. Mm-hmm. And I have, you know, family members who are on the opposite side of the divide, as I keep saying. Mm-hmm. And this project has certainly made those relationships easier.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'm practicing all the time.
Mm-hmm. Has it been a healing journey for you to write these letters?
Yes. Yes.
What else have you learned about yourself?
Well, despite the two stories that I have told here today, I have learned that this work doesn't come as naturally to me as I wish it did, honestly. For me, to stay in a place of radical kindness and tolerance takes a lot of practice. It is a discipline. It is a discipline that I have to commit to and train for every day.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someday that won't be true, but for me right now it is.
Mm-hmm. I think that's probably true for most people. I mean, there's so much happening in the world. I think we have access to information and media in different ways that we just never did in the past. And our bodies and our brains aren't prepared. We're still evolving to have just information overload coming to us all the time. And
yeah,
I'm with you. There are times where, even though I believe in this work, I have to have my days where I step back and say, you know, I need to just lay on the couch and watch a movie because that's all I can do today. And that's
kind of fair enough
where I am in that process.
Yeah.
You do have an option for people to submit letters through your site, but you're really seeing more themes and comments at this point. I think that could be related back to what we were just talking about. Some people love the idea. They're showing up to your site. They're showing up in your space, but they've not yet written their own letters. And it takes time, right? Like, people may get there, but it takes time for them to see others modeling this kind of concept and behavior. What are some themes you're hearing from people as they're interacting with you about your work?
Mm-hmm. The thing I hear most often is that the letters make people feel hopeful. And someone told me a few days ago, and this actually meant a lot to me. There's a woman who said, it makes me think that I need to work harder with my own family members. And I think that's great. I did put out a video at some point and said, you know, on my website, I can actually see when people are visiting the website, and I can see that they're coming from all over the world, but no one writes me a letter. And so I said, write back, you know, write back. It's okay. It's safe. But I think we have all stepped back because that got to be so painful that a lot of people just kind of, you know, got out of the ring. Mm-hmm. And I don't blame them. I understand. But I am, you know, trying to gently draw people in. So mm-hmm. I get a lot of comments and a lot of messages. I have yet to get a Dear Sarah letter, but I'm anxiously awaiting that day.
Yeah. And you do have it open for others to submit letters to you.
Sure.
Or if they want to submit a letter to an old friend or a parent, and they don't have the courage yet to say this to that friend or parent, they can do it through your site. And so just for our own listeners out there, it's a place where they can go and practice this before they actually sit down and have some of these conversations.
Yeah.
What would you say to someone who wants to reconnect with an old friend or family member on the opposite side of the political and social spectrum? As our folks are listening to this, we're heading into another election. What would you say to folks who just haven't quite taken that step yet?
Mm-hmm. I would say have a plan, first mm-hmm. and foremost. The first step has to do with preparation, because I think, you know, one has to assume that the person on the other side of the conversation has not changed. Maybe they have, and if they have, great, but probably safer to assume that they haven't. So I think, you know, the person who wants to reach out has to take a look at themselves and figure out what in them has changed, so that, you know, you don't end up just repeating the same dynamic. So have a plan. I think it's good to have practiced some before you try to have a difficult conversation. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, your plan, maybe if you know that this person is not going to be able to have any sort of conversation without getting upset, it may be that you decide just to practice radical acceptance. Mm-hmm. You know, with full knowledge that the person is not going to change, and you have done your own work such that you can show up with the sort of radical acceptance. Now, if you are in a position where it's not safe to do that, where you just, you know, consistently feel unsafe, then maybe that's not possible. But it is an option, you know, if you feel mm-hmm. safe. Mm-hmm. But one way or the other, I think one has to prepare and practice a little bit. Mm-hmm. And like you said, maybe try writing a letter mm-hmm. first. And then be brave and do it. Mm-hmm. Reach.
And sometimes it starts with just one person. And as you were saying, sometimes it's radical acceptance. And somebody may think, oh, but I can't radically accept this person because they maybe I'm pro-choice and they're pro-life. And that's a sticking point that we just can't get beyond, and I can't do that. But going back to finding that person in your life, if it's a parent or if it's not a parent because you don't have that relationship, and maybe it's an old friend, like identifying that one person that you can go to that level with right before you decide, you know what, I'm going to try to fix my relationships with these five people. That may be too much. Maybe it's just starting with that one person, right? Like the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step, right? The old Chinese proverb.
Right.
So maybe it's just finding that one person to practice radical acceptance and radical yeah. love and radical empathy to find the path forward.
Right.
I want to go back to another letter in your series. In letter 7, you write about a song that your then partner, who is a very famous country singer, had released in the years after 9/11 that was a sympathetic view of John Walker Lynn, who, for our listeners who might be younger and don't know, weren't alive during this time, John Walker Lynn was a 21-year-old American who in 2002 was caught fighting for the Taliban in Afghanistan. Although the general public was critical of the lyrics that your then partner wrote, most defended his right to write the song. But it does feel like times have changed and that nuanced views are out. So in part, I do think, as we've talked about before, social media has played into the siloing of viewpoints. And there's just so much vitriol and attacks and canceling that's happening on both sides. And I do feel like that silenced people with more moderate views. And it also reminds me of other ways voices are being silenced. Book bans, fears of what's being taught in schools, demonizing other people. We're just really living in finger pointing times to try to figure out who's against us and who do we take down, right? It feels like that sometimes. But as I'm recording this season of the radio show and talking to guests, I'm asking everyone this one question. I'd love to know your thoughts on it. And you and I both argue that, you know, stories will save us. I'm a firm believer in that. You're a firm believer in that. But how do we create a more empathetic world in a time when listening has decreased and each person's message is competing with millions of others?
By engaging, I would say. So yes, there are literally millions of crazy makers out there, politicians and pundits and folks on social media screaming and hollering and trolling. But what we have to remember is that there are many millions more people who are, in fact, really reasonable. And the problem, I think, is that we let the crazy making cacophony shut us down because it's noisy out there, it's messy, it's unpleasant. And so we disengage, right? We distance ourselves from the fray, we hide in our silos. But we simply must re-engage. I feel so strongly about that. And I think we can do that in a few different ways. There are so many great organizations out there doing this kind of bridge building work. Your Facing Project, which I so dearly love, is an option.
No, thank you.
If you want to have, you know, the conversations, you can look up your local chapter of Braver Angels and take part in a facilitated conversation. You can look up Living Room Conversations and literally host a conversation with people from both sides of the divide in your living room, you know, with a facilitated script and help. And I understand that we've all gotten to the point where we avoid those difficult conversations at all costs because they're so unpleasant. But the more we can model healthy dialogue across the political divide, the smaller that divide becomes. Mm-hmm. And above and beyond that, JR, I think I go back to your idea of radical love. I go back to the quote by Saint John of the Cross, where there is no love, put love and you will find love.
Mm-hmm. And love will light the way.
Yeah.
To a brighter future, hopefully. Sarah Sharp, thank you so much. You're an author, you're an actor, you're an activist, you're a coach. You do so many things. And on top of that, you also founded the Letters Project, which I am in love with. And I think it's a great way to get people to reconnect, even if they're not doing it in person yet, reconnect through their own writing and healing process to have these deeper conversations once they sit down face to face. So thank you so much for joining me today on the Facing Project.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can learn more about Sarah Sharp and the Letters Project at theLettersProject.org. Many thanks once again to Sarah Sharp of the Letters Project for joining me on today's show. To listen to past episodes of this program, visit indianapublicradio.org/thefacingproject or find us on your favorite podcasting app, or just ask your smart speaker to play The Facing Project on NPR. To continue the conversation about this episode, find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Facing Project. The Facing Project is recorded at Indiana Public Radio at Ball State University in beautiful and wonderful Muncie, Indiana. And it's produced by the amazing producer and audio engineer extraordinaire, Sean Ashcraft. The show is distributed nationally through PRX. I'm your host, J.R. Jameson. And until next time, I wish you the courage to share your own story and the empathy to listen to others.